if in my high moments I have done some good, offered some service, shed some light, healed some wounds, rekindled some hope, or stirred some warmth of apathy and indifference, or in any way along the way helped somebody, then this campaign has not been in vain.
Andrew Gordon. Welcome, Sarah Gerard, to the show. And I'm currently speaking to you out of your base, which is now NYC.
Yes, I am live here in Brooklyn right now.
Big up the Brooklyn! Blah,
blah. Yeah. So happy to be here. Thank you. Thank you so much for reaching out and inviting me.
You know, thank you so much for being on the show. And I want to preface this statement with respect and humility to say that this show is different in a lot of ways than many podcasts that have to do with yoga. But to have people like you come on shows that even people that are so versed in the practice and in their teaching of it understand, or I believe understand what I'm doing, to come on, and that it doesn't have to be a certain type of show to get such experienced yogis that they'll still come on the show too. So it for me, it feels good to have someone like you on. And of course, I'll get to all of your experience for people that aren't familiar with you, but you have a very well-versed background in this practice and truly respect it. And I respect you and your path. So I just wanted to make a statement about that, that I appreciate it. And it gives credibility from the yoga standpoint that really polished yogis and people who are true to this and live it and really make a life out of it have been and still come on the show, as well as other guests who are from other avenues, and we do different takes on all different things. It's about life in general, which to me, yoga is life, life is yoga. So there's a natural weaving of the two.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. That's really kind of you. I appreciate it. And you know, the appreciation is mutual. And I do respect what you're doing in showing the approachable nature of yogis and a yogic lifestyle, that we can be humans in this modern world and also have a very mindful and purposeful, you know, existence. I think that, you know, whenever we come from a place of authenticity, of like, yes, really who we are as human beings, that is always going to be an essence of truth. And so I think that, yeah, you're sharing something that is really exciting. So thank you for having me.
I appreciate it. Well, you grew up in Venice, California. So would you say that you are still a Cali girl, or to a New Yorker, or are you by that postal?
Yeah. Actually, it's so funny that you asked this first off. I was talking to a client yesterday because I celebrated 5 years here in New York City now.
I was going to ask you about that, but congratulations.
Thank you. They're like, well, you're officially a New Yorker. And I was like, oh, I don't know if I am. I think Woody Allen says 10 years to be officially a New Yorker. My heart is always going to be in LA, in Venice, yeah, Beach, specifically where I grew up. It was interesting growing up there, you know, it's always changed, as both cities have changed a lot in the past few decades. And Brooklyn, and Venice, yeah, is a very different place than when I grew up there.
How so?
And when I go back and visit, well, there's always an element to Venice that I love that's a little scrappy, that it's artistic, and it's a little bit more rough around the edges, if you will.
Yes.
And there is an authenticity, I think, to it. And, you know, in the past 10 years, a lot of big companies have moved into Venice because they love that kind of authenticity, that grit of Venice, and also the affordable, you know,
sure,
places to live next to the beach. And so things have just shifted, I think, in some ways for the better, and in some ways it's making it a little bit difficult, for, you know, in terms of housing and that kind of thing in Venice. But there's an element of Venice that's never changed. And so it's really wonderful to go back and just remember, oh yeah, this is part of who I am.
can I ask you one element that maybe hasn't changed since you were a kid? Did everyone still ride a bicycle?
Yeah.
It seems like you need a bike there. And that's because I watched this show with Will Arnett on Netflix. There was like one, Flaked.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, and it was in Venice and he rode a bicycle. And it's like,
he's
got a bike there.
It is kind of nice to get around on a bike, truthfully, because if you live on the west side of Los Angeles, you have to get into your car to get anywhere else, right, in LA. Yes. It's a bit far to go anywhere else. So that when you are in Venice, like, can we just get rid of the cars and just be on a skateboard or be on a bike or, you know, low emissions transportation is great. And they have this really amazing thing now in Venice. It's called, what is it called? Oh, it's a scooter system. It's not Razor, because what is it? It's Bird. It's called Bird, I believe.
What's up and with that?
It is incredible. It is geo coordinating where these scooters are, and you have an app, and there's no docking stations or anything. You just find one of these Bird scooters on the side of the street. And then you can use it, and it tallies, you know, how long you're on the scooter for a couple minutes or whatever. And then you just drop it off wherever you are. And it's kind of like City Bike. We have City Bike here in New York. It's kind of like a bike sharing program, but it's for scooters. So it's great for tourists visiting who don't have something, or if you're just wanting to like jet around the area. Because Venice is, I mean, it's not necessarily totally walkable. Like if you want to get from one end to the other, you know, efficiently, you take some wheels.
Let's give it up for Bird.
Bird. Yeah. I get no money through endorsing this.
Bird is the word.
I just thought it was really cool. Yeah.
I think I talk about so many things without getting paid. I just make a list of things that I said and like be like, yeah, look, I mentioned you like 3 times in this episode.
Yeah. And it's just paying it forward. It's just showing the good love, you know?
This is true. Well, before we go any further, because you had a question for me.
I did.
It has to do with the intro of the show that nobody's ever asked. And before we move any further into your story, I wanted to give you an answer. And you can ask me the question because I want to save it for the interview.
Yes. What is this? Because there's a speech at the beginning, and then there's a chant from a chorus of individuals. Yes. What is it that they are chanting?
Okay, so the intro, which I hope everyone likes. It's a combination of things that really got me inspired. And the speech is Jesse Jackson's concession speech when he ran for president.
Mm. Okay.
You don't really think of a concession speech as inspiring, but I believe his words in that speech were.
Mm. I definitely can think of a concession speech as being inspiring because somebody who's rallied so much support around them, you know, has kind of harnessed the attention of a group of people. And then if they don't win the majority, right, then there can be, okay, this kind of, what do we do now if you've been supporting this person? Exactly. And so I think that very often concession speeches can be the most motivating.
And I love the line is what really hooked me is, this campaign shall not be in vain.
Interesting. And do you think that that's like your personal ethos behind, you know, what you're doing in this podcast?
Absolutely, I reference that in my mind. Like, it should not go in vain, you know? It's a really serious interview or it's a little more goofy.
Yeah.
That it's not in vain. There's something from it that people can take away if it's one thing.
I love that.
It will not be in vain. Now, the other thing, the people chanting, this is something that I really found powerful. And how I mixed all this together, I don't know. I was just finding things. But it's the people chanting when the Berlin Wall came down. And it's the people on the other side from chanting to the other side going, we're right here. We're right here.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
I love that. It's such an image of unity.
Yeah. So those two things were really, to use your word, ethos, is the truth of why I use them, because I do feel it's in alignment with my vision for the show is unity and that it won't be in vain.
Amazing.
Yes. so this campaign shall not be. And Jesse Jackson's known for rhyming. You know, he's like the Dr. Seuss of politicians when he was in politics, you know?
Yeah.
So this campaign shall not be in vain. There will be no pain. Everything will not be the same from episode to episode.
You love it. As we it's amazing.
And flow. Okay, back to you. Growing up in Venice, and thank you for asking that, because I just was waiting instead of putting it out there for someone to ask me, and that's what it is.
I'm so glad that I did. I'm so glad that I asked it, because those two kind of quotes, you know, speaks to truth and unity, which is a lot of, you know, what I find personally and profound in the yoga practice, right? Yoga is very often translated, you know, just easily as union or yeah. that joint, right? It is connectedness. And then what is it that we're trying to find? You know, truth, love, light, you know, that essence. You know, this is distilling all of the teachings down really, really, you know, really simply. But I think that that's interesting. I love that that's part of your opening for every single episode.
Well, thank you for noticing and for asking me. Yeah. Going back to yoga, taking you back to your truth, something happened in a class I taught like 2 days ago. And it mm-hmm. was from a guy in class. And we were in hero's pose. And, you know, you can always modify it. And if you sit in full hero's pose, it's like when we were kids and we sat down like a frog, you know what I mean? and he said to me, man, you know, this whole thing, it's like, I'm not a kid anymore. I can't sit like the way I was when I was a kid. And I was like, okay, well, that's a physical in my mind, a metaphor. But really the other part are the layers of all this stuff through our lives that we peel away. And we come back to that essence of a kid being like unbiased, unfettered, and just clear.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
I think that that's so, so important to remember. You know, we can get so separate from that innocence and unfettered nature as who we were in our essence as children. And that sometimes the practice is about remembering, right, who we are at our most innocent self. And it is so important for us to remember who we are as children. And this is interesting because I've been thinking about this a lot too, in terms of my stories of like what my childhood was and my upbringing. I didn't even appreciate, I had no idea how good I had it when I grew up in Venice, like literally a step and a jump away from the beach. I didn't know what the opposite was. I just took it for granted because I was a child. It was just, that was what was happening.
In all fairness, Sarah, you had it good geographically, but you did have a challenge that most children don't experience in your childhood. You had a rare form of eye cancer, which made you spend a lot of time in a hospital. So can you tell me more about that time in your life, what it was like then, and then how it impacted your life all the way moving forward?
Absolutely. And so I was about 2.5 years old, and my family started noticing that I was regressing spatially. So in terms of, you know, a 2.5-year-old, they're a toddler, they're trying things, they're running around and doing things, but they started noticing that I would like run into walls or that I would reach for something and not really get it. And then they also noticed that my right eye actually started developing a little film over it, kind of like a cat eye.
A cat.
Like kind of sick. And so they took me into the doctors at UCLA, Jules Stein Eye Institute. And within the course of 2 weeks, right, everything just timing wise worked out perfectly, that it was like the right doctor at the right time, right before his vacation scheduled surgery.
Wow.
And they were like, yeah, it's called retinoblastoma. And it was cancer of the retina and very, very close to the optic nerve. And so, you know, if it goes into the optic nerve, it goes right into the brain, or, you know, and it goes through the rest of the body. I had it unilaterally, so I just had it in one eye.
Yeah.
And they were able to remove the eye itself.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And within 2 weeks, from my parents questioning something to, you know, 2 weeks later, I was basically cancer free. Like they had taken out the eye and they say, okay, we think that we've localized it completely. It didn't get to the brain or the lymph nodes. We kind of think that we're in the clear, but it was back in the 80s, you know, and even putting a toddler under, you know, anesthesia back then was
yes.
dangerous, right? They didn't even, they thought they could potentially kill me through just putting me out.
Oh my God.
And so luckily I never did need to go through chemotherapy or radiation, because my left eye was healthy, but I did have to go through a massive series of tests. I was under a watchful eye, no pun intended,
for many years.
Much through my childhood, like in the doctor's office, in the hospital, getting put under every month, every, you know, 3 to 6 months until I was about 12 years old. And wow. So I grew up in and out of the hospital with a lot of friends, a lot of kids who were a lot sicker than me, truthfully. Yeah. And there was this presence of, you know, mortality. That's kind of what I grew up with. And I was thinking about that yesterday, actually, of just like, what is the soul? Like, we think of like our whole body, whole minded, whole spirited experience, right? Mind, body, spirit.
Yes.
Is spirit. And when I was a really young age, you know, when we start to question mortality or, you know, where did grandma and grandpa go when they die?
Yeah.
You know, that's when we start to contemplate, oh, what is the soul? What is the spirit? And I'm so grateful that my parents made the space for me to continue questioning. You know, they didn't necessarily have the answers for me, because I would always ask, you know, I'd cry and I would not know, like, why did this happen to me?
Yeah.
And they would answer like, I don't know. They didn't have the answers. And so they were able to sit in that sense of mystery and just make a loving space of just like, we love you and we don't know why, but we can keep asking these questions together. And, you know, I say that I went through the experience of having cancer, but I, you know, I was a child. I didn't know any different.
Yeah.
There's the bliss of ignorance and youth.
Right.
My family had a child with cancer.
Mm.
And I could imagine, you know, being an adult now, I don't have any children of my own, but that heartbreaking trauma and tragedy of having a child, that there's nothing that you could have done to prevent it.
What a paradigm shift for you to shift and view it from that perspective.
Yeah. It's an incredibly like a humbling and, you know, just kind of change. Yeah. The perspective a little bit, because we can get very kind of insular in our own individual experiences. But I think that when we start to shift towards the other, then some generous, you know, living can happen too.
So before we get to college, and the years there, mm-hmm. I just want to ask you, you know, how all of those challenges and the, what I just heard you say, I didn't know, you know, the approach your parents took to it, which I really love that they didn't fabricate some story to placate you. They just said, we don't know, which is a beautiful vulnerability, but I believe a great way to handle it. How did that affect you through your later years, before college and then right on through college until today?
Well, I mean, I'm going to be honest. There was a lot of, you know, there was a mystery. Like, I had cancer and then I didn't have cancer. And so there was a lot of this kind of like, oh, she's a magic baby that I grew up with. And I'm the youngest of my family. So there's a bit of, right? So we're the perfect ones. So there's a bit of that kind of complex around, you know, the youngest one and, oh, she lived. So I definitely had that kind of personality of perfectionism growing up. I was definitely voted like class perfectionist in middle school. And it was some stuff that like I've definitely had to kind of excavate, because when we, you know, when we feel like we know everything or that we have it all together, the truth is in the underlying circumstance, we don't know anything. And we just don't want anybody to know that. right? And we're putting on this protection, right? To say, oh,
agreed.
Yeah, I've really got it all figured out, when in reality, inside, I have no idea.
To know is not to know.
Exactly. To answer is to really find more questions. And so I definitely had that going, you know, growing up. And I was a really active kid. I have a lot of energy. And so my mom was just trying to figure out, what would you do? Like, what, I gotta contain this child a little bit. I've gotta steer her energy. And so I started dancing a bit, because I'm terrible at contact sports. I'm terrible at catching a ball, at throwing a ball. You know, even being in the water, I love, you know, swimming, but my brother is the surfer of the family. And I really felt like I needed to do something on my own. That was special. So I danced a bit. But then I also started practicing yoga when I was about 14.
Now hold up on that. I promise you, I'm going to get back to that.
Yeah.
I want to save it. I want to move forward with the dance. Mm-hmm. And moving into college. You went to UCLA for musical theater.
I did.
So I'm going to ask this next question like it's a Broadway play.
Okay.
Are you still acting? And what is your favorite play? Can we get a sample of a song you like to sing?
You're so theatrical. I love it. I love it. Yes. No. I actually.
So much better than me.
I actively took a step back about 3 years ago from auditioning. It is one of the hardest things I think a human could ever do is put yourself into that lineup of possible, you know, opportunity and face rejection and, you know, over and over and over again. And what I also found too in, you know, my perfectionist nature was that I was so busy being an actor or fulfilling these roles for other people that I was like, hold up, I need a moment to just figure out who I am for me. And I have worked and lived, you know, supporting myself in theater for about 10 years, you know, out of college. It's something that I love so much. To me, going into a theater is like going into a church. A theater to me is a holy space because there's so much creativity and life and possibility that happens there. And it's, you know, a sharing of the human experience. It's where we share stories, and stories is where we know about ourselves, how we learn about ourselves. And so I always feel that I will be connected to story and will be connected to the creative spirit. I've written and produced and performed a one-woman show, and that was about 3 years ago. And that was the last thing that I did. But I definitely do feel a calling back to the theater in some way or another. I don't have anything coming up.
No. This is just an irony that you're into this, but I have a service where I produce other people's podcasts and edit the sound and the storylines for them. And one is called That One Audition with Alicia Oxy. She's an actress, but I love the freaking podcast. And I love that she's a client. I get to produce it and edit with these actors and actresses. It's like inside the actor's studio, raw. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? It's like the reality show of inside the actor's studio. It talks about a lot, you know, auditioning and going through that process and what it's really like. One of the interviews I just edited, he's going to be on Westworld the next season, and I don't watch TV.
Oh, I really am bad at that.
Which is, I always tell Alicia, it's great that I don't know about that world because I can edit and create the storylines from my perspective as someone that's not jaded to the industry.
Right.
The guy, Neil Jackson.
Jackson.
So Neil Jackson was in the movie Alexander. He was in some Oliver Stone stuff. I don't know. Anyway, so he's going to be on a second season of Westworld, but he came out from England to LA and then he hit like a drought, right? And he's talking about this on That One Auditions podcast. And as I'm editing and I'm listening, I'm getting so inspired that he was driving Uber and he had this big fear of, oh my God, I'm broke. And people that recognize me are going to see me driving Uber and all these egotistical fears, which I get, you know. Yeah. And on his first ride that he picked up, it was like two of his best friends, these two guys that are married. And then they were on their way to pick up a third person who was leaving a premiere, and then she said, can you take us to Seth MacFarlane's house because he's having a party and you can be my plus one? He's like, I gotta work, like I got more rides to pick up, you know.
So yeah,
he went through that and just pressed on, and I just found that, like, and he said all his worst fears were on that first ride. Everything with the stories he told them in his head, all the worst case scenarios happened, and he said after that it was like, well, why am I feeling bad for supporting myself or for doing what I need to do? And I think that even for people teaching yoga that they are still hustling and trying to find, you know, their way into the full-time aspects of it, it resonated with me, just as a human piece. So
100%. I mean, fear is such a powerful force. You know, it is something that we can, you know, it's something that can guide us into action. I think, you know, moving out to New York was probably one of the most terrifying things that I could have ever done at the moment. And so therefore I'm kind of looking at things that are I'm terrified of. And now as kind of like maybe I should go ahead and just do that, because it's just a sign that that's where I'm going to grow the most. You know, and he started doing it. It's interesting in your story, he started doing it. And at once he faced his fear and started moving into it and ultimately beyond it, the universe was like, yeah, here's this. And then here's this opportunity. And then here's this opportunity, right? The universe only gives us really what we can handle and exactly what we need. So it's just always, you know, I think that theater and art, you know, some of the most profound souls and greatest minds are people who are connected to the creative spirit and people who are, you know, that you won't actually even find on Broadway, that you'll find in the regional theaters, you know, that are doing such incredible work. People that are teaching at, you know, the university level, who are just so passionate by the work, are absolutely amazing. They're to me my heroes, you know. And that is to say, I have many friends also on Broadway, and I love that also, that community, as it's, there's a lot of energy too in that community and that world, and it's really magnetic too.
Yeah, and the thing that I've heard through the show, because again it's not my world, is that Tony Trucks was on a show, and she's on SEAL Team now, but she's a musical theater person like yourself. Mm-hmm. She was talking about the difference between the kind of supportive community in the theater community in New York, as opposed to the, what's that bitch got on me thing, you know, in the waiting room for auditions in LA, for film and TV, totally different energy. It's more supportive in the theater world.
Well, you know, I can't really speak for film because I don't really do very much of it. Right. But I do know that the longer that you're at, you know, something, you know, the smaller the pools start to get, and the smaller the pools, the more consistent and the more supportive the groups are.
Yeah.
So that, I mean, that happens too with in terms of the yoga world. If you've just been in and teaching, and you go to the same teachers as your other friends and colleagues, and it turns into that as well. And I think that, quote unquote, the hustle can definitely be difficult, or it can also be a community which can uplift and motivate.
I think it
depends on how we look at it. And I think that for the long term, to find a more consistent, like, longevity in either career, if we're going to find community and uplift each other, it's going to be a lot easier to make it last.
I love it. Now, I want to finally segue into yoga. So, you've been practicing for over 20 years and have taught for more than 10. I want to peel all those layers off and go back to your very first yoga class, which you alluded before. It was at age 14. So first of all, this is a four-part question.
Okay, I'll see if I can remember all the questions.
I'll remind you. What brought you to yoga? Was the class in a studio? What was it like? And did you fall in love with it right away? So they all kind of have congruence to them.
Okay, so what was it like? I was 14. It was a yoga class on the beach in front of our house.
Wow.
I know. And it was before school. So it was like sunrise yoga on the beach, and it was donation based. It was a donation based class.
Oh my God.
And all, you know, in theory now as an adult, I'm like, that sounds like the most amazing. Like, I want to do that right now.
I'm right with you in my mind. I'm there.
I want to do that. But as a child, as a teenager who I had to get up extra early to go to the class, my mom was making me go to this class. It was not like a choice of mine, because I had been, you know, doing the Royal Academy of Dancing syllabus, which is it's a program that is created and curated in England, and it's a ballet school basically. And so I had been doing this program, and I'd been dancing a lot, and I developed some injuries, even already at 14. And my physical therapist at that time was like, you either need to do Pilates or yoga. You need to be doing some kind of movement modification. You can't just be doing ballet. because my body wasn't completely built for it. Okay. And so my mom was like, well, Pilates is $100 an hour, or there's a donation-based yoga class. You're going to the donation-based yoga class.
And like, by the way, here's a dose of tough love. It's going to be a class on the beach.
Yeah, exactly. She's like, you'll write this down later. You're going to thank me later. Just do it. There's no question. And so I started doing it. And I hated it. I didn't like it. I, you know, as a teenager who also already felt really kind of awkward in my body, and I was very much in the ballet dance world where it was like control and disconnect from your body. Your body is this something that you don't ever want to fully embrace because you want it to be something else than what it is.
That's interesting. I've never heard that before. Again, that's a world that I don't know about.
Yeah, it was, I mean, that's not the whole dance world. This was just this very specific structure that I grew up with. But it was, I felt weird because the teacher was like telling me to breathe and love my body. And I was like, ugh, no, I don't want to love my body. I hate my body. Like literally that was my thought process as a 14-year-old.
Like many teens and quite honestly, like many adults still do.
And so I hated it, but I kept on going. And about 3 years later, I stopped dancing, but in that ballet world, and I started feeling much more embraced into the theater dance world, which was definitely like much more, you know, free and expressive and enjoying our bodies. And I love practicing all kinds of movement now. But it wasn't until I was actually in college. And I was in the wake of like my very first like heartbreak, depression, that one of my friends, again, dragged me to yoga. And I had this kind of epiphany, you know, that we have that moment where it's just like, oh, I'm home. Oh, I came back to my body in a way that like I had never, ever felt before. I was familiar with the practice. And I was like, whatever, sure, I'll go. But that the moment that like I was there in Shavasana where, you know, you kind of go away and you're feeling disconnected but completely absorbed with everything. And that experience, I was just like, oh, this is what I've been missing. This sense of connection to
so
just
beautiful.
Myself. And then I was able to like take that back into my work, into my auditions. And so from there, I started managing studios. You know, I just kind of hung around the studio until they gave me a job. And then I was doing, you know, yoga and teaching yoga and performing for a very long time. Well, up until like 3 years ago when I was just like, okay, I just need to teach yoga solely.
Well, what was your style of training? It doesn't really matter to me, but I think to people listening, it would be an interesting question just to see the first style that you learned. And of course, you can probably teach a million things at this point, but what was that training like?
Well, I started at the Santa Monica Power Yoga Studio because that was also a donation-based studio. And I could
By the way, what's the best country in the world?
The best country?
Yeah.
Is this a trick question?
Donation.
Donation-based yoga is pretty rad.
Yeah, the best country is donation.
Oh, donation.
Yeah.
Oh, I want that.
Thank you. I'll be here all week. Try
it. Amazing.
Take my wife.
But I loved it. Yeah, I loved that. It was just like everybody was welcome. And so I really started practicing with those teachers. And my first teacher training that I took was at the the National Yoga Institute in Santa Monica. It was on second Ave. I don't think it actually exists anymore.
It sounds fancy.
It sounds real fancy, right? But it was my first 200-hour teacher training. And you know, I was in the very first class that did it, that the teachers had created this program. So we were all kind of bumbling together and creating the program together. So it was a lot of learning, of course, along the way. And that was kind of as the 200-hour, first 200-hour process is, it's kind of like, oh, this is the tip of the iceberg, right? yoga asana is just one piece of this whole unfolding path. It's like, wow, there's so
Absolutely. I wish more people I just knew that.
Right? I know. I think that, well, you're helping. You're helping people learn that.
I'm trying. I mean, we talked yesterday on a podcast I did with Aaron Ward about, I was seeing a lot of people on Instagram more and more. I'm a self-taught yogi. And I'm like, huh? Like, how is that? Like, you, okay, so you learn the poses and you can kind of, I guess, read about stuff, but you really need a guide. I don't know. Like, it just, whatever. If it works for someone, cool. More people doing yoga is great. Mm-hmm. But the process of teacher training is so transformational on so many levels.
Exactly, on so many levels. And I'm so grateful I'm going to be assisting the goddess, Jodi Rufti, here in New York City for a Yoga Works teacher training now, in June. And it's an intensive. I'm so excited for that. Because I know that I'm going to be, I'm learning still through the teaching process. And yeah, I mean, you brought this up, this whole kind of teacher-student mentality. It's a relationship that is very kind of fraught with a lot of different experiences.
Yes.
Throughout the years, and there's so much information that's available online now, right? I have classes online. Like, I do things every week. There are ways in which we can access people all the time, but there is something to be said about having a very specific relationship with an instructor whose eyes are on you, who has your focus, who can be a mirror, right? All of our relationships are mirrors. They show us where we shine and where we, you know, where we are a little, you know, dull, or where our shadows are, you know? And so I think that
that's a great analogy.
I've heard it around. I didn't create it.
Justin Timberlake song.
Most likely. You're like, oh yeah, you're my mirror.
Like, you're my mirror.
But there's, I think that relationship is so important. And I've had so many different teachers along the way. And for some time, I actually even prided myself in not having a guru. Like, I don't have a specific teacher that I put on a pedestal that I, you know, idealize.
That's because you're a teacher and you know that you wouldn't want someone to do that to you.
I guess. I mean, I think it was just part of me just being a contrarian and, you know, really pretending that I knew everything. Like, oh, I don't have a teacher. But like, really, I see so many different teachers, and I see the people that I work with, both privately and in my public classes, as my teachers, as really ways in which I can start to learn through them. I practice here in the city with Nikki Costello, and she's been teaching for 20 plus years. And I value her perspective. And I think that's what's really important too about finding a teacher, because I understand I'm not going to be the kind of voice that everybody needs to hear. Right. I think that was part of the pitfalls that I fell into being a new teacher, was that, like, I just want to teach everybody. And it's like, no, I don't think I'm going to be for everybody, truthfully, but it's going to take a while, right, to find that teacher that kind of speaks on your frequency, that uses words that really resonate with you. I say, give a teacher like 2 or 3 classes before you make a decision about them.
I agree.
You know, because we have off days, we have days in which the MTA gets us down or whatever. We don't know. We're human.
Well, you know, Sarah, it's interesting. You answered a question I was going to ask you next. A piece of advice you could give to a brand new teacher, if you want to add to it, by all means do so. But you said, don't try to be everything to everyone, because you can't, and you should just find your own voice and be yourself. So I thought that was a beautiful answer to that question, if I were to had been prompted to you, but you kind of answered it organically. Is there anything else you'd like to offer advice wise for someone just starting? Now, you've been teaching for a long time, so a brand new teacher.
Yeah, for a brand new teacher, I just say, welcome to the journey.
There's too much to say. I get it.
Yeah, you're on the path now. Like, you're on a journey. You already have been on the journey for a while. Like, you've loved yoga enough to do a teacher training, to make that commitment to it, because it's a financial investment. It's a big thing. And very often, you know, the intensive training that I'll be teaching and co-teaching and assisting in June is a big time commitment, right? It's 4 weeks, 9 to 5.
Yes.
You know? And so people very often are in a transition period of their life.
That's
so,
right.
You know, if you've just finished your first 200 hour, just say, welcome. You know, now you're on this journey, you're on this path. And there are so many teachers out there now.
Yep.
Right there. And that I've had the 200 hour level, and we can start teaching technically at that 200 hour level, but I would say keep learning, right?
Yeah. You
keep
have like, going. I think in one of your notes I picked up, it's like 1,000 continuing at hour. You're at the 1,000 hour level, which is,
it's not
really the number that's important to me. It's your dedication to continuously learning.
Yeah. And I think that that's what makes us interesting. You know, it makes me interested to go to a teacher's class if I know that they are constantly inquiring and constantly learning, because that's what it's about. You know, teaching is just assisting other people kind of making their own discoveries. And yes. So if we can just be in a room of discovery, and this is why the practice seems to be constantly unfolding for me, is that there is always something to be learning. Thankfully, we're not finished. Thankfully, I don't know it all.
Sarah, I think you just answered the next question I was going to ask you again.
Yeah.
So here, if you want to add to it, I want to switch to the teachers that are experienced and may feel burnt out or stale. What advice can you give them?
Take your time. I find truthfully when I am, I actually even mentioned this in my Instagram stories this week, that I was feeling like burnt out. Like I was just like, I am tapped dry. Yes. Julia Cameron, who wrote the beautiful book, The Artist's Way, okay. In the very beginning, she talks about artist states and doing your morning pages and doing things that fill your well. And I think that is so important for artists, for people who are, you know, making creative connections and stories in their lives, but also for teachers.
Yes.
You know, that there's so much that we're offering for people in the room, you know, and bringing our energy and bringing every single thing that we have physically, mentally, emotionally. And if we're feeling tapped dry or burnt out or just like, I'm over this practice, I've figured it all out, there's probably just a moment if you take some time to, you know, fill your well. To do that which, you know, is enriching in your life, that's nourishing, you know, physically, like what feeds you, but then also like being around people that are exciting, looking to the wisdom texts. Like there are always wisdom texts out there to look at, to research. And it's the Bhagavad Gita. Yes, it's the sutras, but I think for modern yogis, it's like there's so much that's possible that's at our fingertips. There's so many amazing books out there. It's just taking time to keep investigating.
That's a great answer.
Because ultimately, like teachers, we want to be coming from a place of abundance. We don't want to be tapped dry. And trust me, like living in New York City is a grind. It's so hard. It's one of the reasons why I moved out here was I'm feeling a call, because in LA, it's really easy to be meditative and chill, right? When you live next to the beach and it's beautiful and it's 72 degrees and sunny every day.
Yep.
And I was like, there's a need in New York City. Like, so I do a lot of corporate work too. I go into big businesses.
Absolutely.
To like just get people to take a moment to quiet, you know. And I was like, if I can just do this for like, if I can get somebody to just breathe for like 3 minutes in the center of downtown, you know, New York City, then I'm like, that's good. That's enough.
If there's ever a place that needs it, that is the place. So you have a way of conducting your classes, and you talk about these commitments that you create in the space that you cultivate. And one of the things you talk about is that it's a space for courageous action. So I want to ask you, can you recall time when a student did something that resonates with that sentiment and how it made you feel as a teacher?
You know, one of the most courageous actions I think truthfully that we can ever do is to let go.
Yeah.
It's so hard. I was working with a client last week, actually, who has a case of what we now know and we call lovingly yoga butt. So are you familiar with it? The overextension and the inflammation.
Yes.
String attachment.
Yeah.
And yeah. Hypermobility and kind of working, you know, in a very kind of unidirectional way can create imbalances in the body. And so therefore she's had, you know, yoga butt. And so we're working in a different way to start to strengthen the glutes and to strengthen the system that had been over time really pulled to excess.
Yes.
And when we create this kind of imbalance in the body, right, overworking one area, like creating a laxity, then another part of the body to compensate will create kind of a hypertonic quality of just like over tightening.
Yes.
And so the way that we were working, you know, we were working to train the areas that was really lax, but then also to train the muscles that were hypertonic to soften a little bit, to let go. And I was talking. I was like, okay, we're creating the structure, and the structure in which you can now safely release into. And she wasn't getting it. And I was like, okay, we'll just keep on playing around. And she's like, I'm so scared that I'm gonna hurt myself. And
wow.
This is where the relationship of teacher and student is really important, right? When we can start to really trust the teacher, is like, okay, because I'm as a teacher, I'm trusting the technique, the lineage, all of the education that I've gone through, all of my experience, and personally knowing that I've had to do this work with my hips too.
Yes.
Like I was like, okay, I'm trusting my lineage. I'm trusting this work. I know that I'm taking you into the best possible place for you.
I love it.
She just started to trust. And she was just like, and then she started softening and letting go in a certain part I was like, what did you do?
Yeah.
She's like, oh, I just let go. I was like, oh, that's so easy and simple in theory, but it's so courageous in practice.
I think we could take so many pieces of that story you just told and use it in our teaching. The fact that in general, if you're pulling one area, you're pushing another area, or if you're strengthening one area, you're stretching another area, and you broke it down in your specific teaching situation in a lot more detail than I just did. But the basic premise, and also something that's such a mental concept, how it applied to the physical of letting go. It was that there were so many layers to that story, which was just awesome. Mm-hmm. I didn't want it to go unnoticed. I really wanted to stop for a moment and pause on that.
Thank you. I mean, because we're not separate. Like that's the thing that we think that we are, that like, I am this body, I am my mind, I am my spirit. Like we're not compartmentalized, that it's a holistic practice.
Yes.
And truthfully, our body only, like in terms of movement styles, our body can't discern between yoga asana and walking down the street and dancing, you know, it's all movement to our bodies.
Yes.
And so it's like, and then there's a whole mental component to it because we are a whole being.
Yes.
So yeah, it's integrated.
Now I want to ask you, speaking about things that are whole and filled up, your resume. Okay. Now this is not a job interview because you clearly have more than enough jobs. So I want to break it down. You're the National Director of Meditation Programs at Bootcamp Republic. So first of all, what do you do in that role and what's your favorite part about it?
Interesting. I've actually started to, the company has had a name change. They are now known as Culture of Fit. And for the past 2.5 years, what I've basically been doing for them is program development and assisting them in creating some proprietary programs for the corporate sector to go
Beautiful.
Into big companies and to offer them and their clients and their employees a yoga basics program.
I'm telling you bring yoga to the people rather than trying to fish them. So now I'm not saying like, I'm just saying you could reach more people who you may not be able to get if you're asking them to come to take yoga. But if you bring it to these places where it's so needed and it's there for them and they have no choice but to say, hey, it's here, I'm going to take it. the whole culture of our society could change little by little in those programs.
Yeah, and it's pretty palpable, truthfully. I go into these companies and, you know, the company cultures in Manhattan, it's and everywhere too.
Yeah,
it's just
yeah.
And in the company cultures, it's always different for each company, obviously, but it's go, 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 deadlines. It's a lot. And so if we can make it more accessible, I think that more people can benefit from it. And what I found too as an individual teacher, that it's easier when I have, say, a company kind of working as the agency to place into companies. It's easier for company to company to talk to each other as opposed to me individual talk to a company, you know, through the HR program and everything like that.
I did so, that. I got a few corporate gigs by reaching out. And conversely, I also worked for a company like yours on a smaller level locally that did it for me as the agency. Mm-hmm. And certainly reaching out on your own, you have to be very diligent.
yes, you do. Yes, 100%. 100%. Yeah, it's a consistency that I was like, I don't know if I have this kind of energy to go chase down these contracts, which is why I worked with that company. Yeah, but now I'm still teaching for them, but it's more on the I do less management and directing and just more, you know, program development if they need any assistance with that.
Well, thank you for, you know, sharing that information about the company and the work that you do with it, because I wasn't clear, but I wanted to know. So I'm glad that the audience at least gets to hear it as well, because I think it's great to bring that to people who need it, who may not seek it out. You teach at Equinox in NYC. You've been there for over 5 years. So what makes that studio so special to you to be there as long as you have?
I teach at both YogaWorks and Equinox in New York City, and I teach at actually 4 different locations at Equinox.
Good Lord.
There's so many different locations. I think something they have like 30 locations in the greater New York area. It's massive. But what I've really discovered and loved is that there is a beautiful need. You know, that yoga is this mind-body modality that helps to balance out other modalities of movement.
Yes.
And as I, you know, am such a fan of all movement and balanced movement and nutritious movement, as I'm a fan of Katie Bowman. She does that. She's incredible. If you haven't checked out her work, everybody should check out her work. But I think that there's a nice balance that yoga can offer in, say, a gym setting. And I do support, you know, my yogis to, you know, pick up a weight and feel what that's like in your muscles and your bones. It's another way into feeling and experiencing and loving these bodies that we are born into.
It's so funny, Sarah, that you said that, because I don't want to call it a New Year's resolution, but one of my intentions for the new year was to incorporate different ways to work my body than just yoga. And I've started taking this class at the gym that I teach yoga at, because I was a studio owner, and then I started hating teaching, and I hated the whole thing. And I got rid of my studios. I went full circle and said, if I ever teach again, I'm just doing it for fun. So I'm back at the gym doing it. I love it. It's like the people there love that I'm there to teach them. It's all good. But I stay after to take this girl's class, which is like one of those body pump classes. So it's like light weights, but you kind of like move with the weights. And I am telling you, it kicks my butt in a different way that I'm so grateful for.
Yeah, exactly. Variety is the spice of life.
It is. You
know, doing something consistently is wonderful, because we will become well-versed in it. We'll become courageous and confident in it. And, you know, having that is incredibly powerful for many of us that feel sometimes disconnected from our bodies.
Can I speak about something you mentioned? I'm sorry, about letting go of thinking that you know it all, right? So I literally teach these people yoga, and I'm the quote-unquote expert in a room in yoga, right? And then afterwards, I'm trying to keep up with the steps and the things that we're doing. And I open myself up to those same people that, hey, this isn't the thing that I'm expert at. Look, here, I'm messing up. It's okay. I love it. And I actually enjoy it.
I love that. And to me, that speaks to you like as such a good teacher, because you're still learning and that you're in that process of willingly putting yourself into a vulnerable place. You know, people will be more likely to go with you into a vulnerable place and, you know, and find a courageous action for themselves when they see you do that too.
That's how it's worked out. You know, we all smile and the community becomes a little bit tighter within the yoga and then the class after that I attend. The fact that I'm opening myself up and the teacher loves that I take her class.
Yeah. And support. It's creating community. It's creating, you know, connectedness. And it's, there's communal experience. I love that you're doing that. That's fantastic.
Yeah,
and I think that our muscles and our bones and our bodies can benefit from so many different types of movement, not just like the concentric and eccentric stretching that we can do in, say, yoga asana, but, you know, picking up, you know, a therapy ball, picking up a roller and, you know, get into your fascia, get into your, all of the musculature and put some depth of pressure there on your muscles, or pick up a weight and see what that's like, or, you know, hang, like actually just like hang.
Yes. Oh my God.
From a bar. Like, what was it like? We used to, you know, do some primal movement.
I mean,
we used to, you know, be all around the woods and forests and trees. And what would that be like in our bodies?
You know, speaking on feeling free and liberating yourself from patterns and routine, the gym that I work at also has a basketball court, you know, and I literally, when I play, I just shoot, right? I just, for fun. And to me, it turns into meditation.
Yes, it's all yoga. And that's the thing I think that's wonderful too about your this podcast is that you're presenting it that yoga is life.
Thank you.
And that all movement, everything that we do can be considered yoga. Right?
Absolutely.
These specific outlined asanas that we do in this one specific mat. There is, I think, importance to that ritual, to that consistency.
Yes.
Right? We can build strength of not just of body, but of mind when we have that technique, but that every single thing that we do, we can then take it off of the mat and into the world, as Sean Korn says, right? We can bring it out with us. This concept of truth that we started off with as your ethos. And then also this sense of connectivity that there's a unity in life and all that we do.
Well, expanding on that, speaking of variety, this is a wild card in your job deck of cards. So you're also the North American runway director for Sassoon. Now, first of all, I didn't even notice who Sassoon was still around because I used to love their Ooh La La Sassoon commercials.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you do for them? Well, I just said what you do for them. But what do you do in that role, and how in the world did you end up in that position?
I know, right? It's always, this is always like the wild card that throws people like, what the? So I have a degree in theater.
Yes.
I know how to produce theater.
Absolutely.
And I was actually, their academy is in Santa Monica. And I was referred to this job by a friend of a friend. I never blanketed a resume, you know, for this. I never submitted for a job, but you know, a friend of a friend referred me and I help them with kind of event production, but I also do everything from, you know, helping the models get cast to helping the artist's vision become kind of manifest and created on stage. You know, if the artist is like, I'm thinking kind of like an Edie Sedgwick meets Kurt Cobain in like a Bauhausian world, the technical director would be like, what do you mean? Like, what, how do I make that happen?
Yeah.
So then there's a little bit of interpretation that I use too, of just like trying to get the artist's vision actually created on stage.
I could see where all of your background adds up, and I would hire you for what you're describing.
And it's a bit too. So then I also help the models walk and feel comfortable in their bodies and feel kind of presenting to with the collection, what, what the artist's intention is.
The energy of it.
The energy of it. And I help it all kind of come together. For me, it is definitely a vinyasa krama, right? To me, it's definitely like skillfully placing everything in a direction towards this one direction of creating story on stage. It's just the different medium. What I loved too, so I actually even worked with Vidal while he was still alive.
Yeah.
He was a cancer survivor as well.
Wow.
And he was a yogi. He was one of the very first, you know, Vidal Sassoon, Jane Fonda. One of the first kind of holistic life gurus that, you know, it's so common right now on Instagram. Like everybody is, even myself included, right? These lifestyle, holistic living individuals. Vidal and Jane Fonda were actually one of the very, like they were the originators. I consider to be these people. Like he would go on these morning shows and talk about how amazing yoga is.
Wow.
And so it actually, that kind of mindfulness pervades the whole company.
Stuff. I love it. It all
and
makes sense now.
It was something like I've worked with them for 8 years and literally they have, to use your word, literally.
I was trying to say it all, you know, brilliant, eloquent.
Literally, to use your word, they have this really holistic approach to style and art, and they have such a foundational. They're so strong in technique in terms of what they offer. You know, hairdressers, hairstylists. If they've been Sassoon trained, you know that they've got a really strong background and technique to rely on. So I love really working with them. They're fantastic.
So with all the things you have going on, what's a little nugget of advice you can offer in terms of not only time management, but energy management as well?
Yeah, absolutely. That's something that I've really come to embrace more here in New York. And being like boundaries are really important. It's taken me a long time to remember that like no is a complete sentence. Say no to something is really important.
Yes.
And what has also helped me, you know, is dedicating specific time for specific things. And giving myself like, okay, for this amount of time, I'm going to be really into this and present with this.
Yes.
You know, taking social media off my phone has been an incredible thing. Right when I moved to New York, I took Facebook immediately off my phone.
Wow.
So that I have like, okay, when I'm on Facebook, I'm going to be on Facebook and I'm going to spend like an hour on it. But I don't need to be constantly checking it every day, all the day, you know, all day long.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I heard an analogy the other day. Now, I'm off Facebook too. I mean, technically my profile is still on, but I don't use it. And Gary Vaynerchuk he was speaking with Larry King.
Mm-hmm.
He was talking about how Facebook, Instagram, and like fill in the blank, Snapchat, they are all different channels. The same you would have to look at. ABC, Showtime, HBO, and CNN, you know, like, so in other words, the way you deliver your message on each of those platforms would have to be different because you wouldn't deliver your message the same as you would on CNN as you would Good Morning America on ABC.
Right.
It was just,
I've never heard of that, but that is very insightful and very true.
Yeah, and of course, everyone listening is, you know, if they're a yogi, then they also have a social media account promoting themselves. So take that little nugget of advice.
And that's true. I mean, that's a whole different world to navigate to, especially if you're a new instructor. Like there's not just one thing like teach. It's now, okay, manage your website and manage your profiles on social media and what platforms of social media. You know, it's never ending.
Yeah, it was at that point Larry King's head exploded. What's going on? Let's go back to Julie in Paducah. Yonia. All right.
Amazing.
Great advice. So besides your presidential run for 2022 coming up, what else you got in the future?
No, I'm really excited about my retreat that's coming up in July. Oh, I'm so
excited. Tell me more.
Yes, we're going to be going to Nicaragua. So as I said, my brother is the surfer of the family, and he's kind of been an expat a little bit down in Nica for almost 10 years now. So this is going to be my fifth Nicaraguan yoga retreat. And I'm so excited, especially this time of the year where it's just gray and we're waiting for the trees to bud here in New York. I'm just aching to get back to a beach. But that's going to be at the end of July and the beginning of August. All the info is on my website. And
we'll link that up, okay? Of course, on the show notes. We'll guide people to you.
Yeah, that would be great. And I'm really excited about seeing what this next year has to offer, truthfully. You know, as I said earlier, the universe really just provides exactly what we need, not necessarily what we want in the moment, but exactly what we need. And I've just been working on increasing my offerings for people online to welcome in more people from more of my previous students from California to practice with me online. I do live streams each week on Thursdays, which are available completely free if you practice with me online as it's happening, but then it's available for replay for a very minimal cost. And that's through the platform sociallive.tv. And if you've never heard of them, they're really awesome. They're a new startup. Just out of London, actually, that they're doing some really awesome work. I'm doing that. And then also, in my classes here in New York City, I teach publicly and privately.
Very cool. And then social media wise, you want to give a little plug for people to connect with you, maybe on Instagram?
Yeah, on both Instagram and I do have a business page on Facebook, Sarah Gerard Yoga. So that's where I am for both.
Very cool. Well, we'll include those all in the show notes. And I just sincerely want to thank you for coming on the podcast. And, you know, clearly you're very busy. So your time is appreciated. Your information is appreciated. And your path and the sharing of your path is so valuable. I truly am grateful to have you on today. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Andrew. This has really been a pleasure. And you're just such a bright light. Thank you. This has been really fun.
Tell my wife. Let her know. She doesn't. All right. Thank you so much. Sarah Gerard.